Welcome to Leadership Unscripted. Today, Baroness Philippa Stroud, CEO of the Laganum Institute and a member of Parliament in the United Kingdom, and UVA Professor Lucy Bassett discuss how to confront social challenges through different organizational systems and the levers that lead to effective social change.
Excited to be here with all of you, albeit virtually, to talk about the incredibly difficult question of what it takes to overcome some of our society's most entrenched problems, from hunger to addiction, from immigration to education. And thrilled to be here with Baroness Stroud, who's an incredible change agent. She spent her career involved in poverty fighting projects, from supporting the heroin addict community in Hong Kong to helping homeless people get off the streets into independent living in the UK. She's worked on fighting human trafficking, advocating for refugees, and creating new poverty measures. As CEO of the Laganum Institute, she forwards this work and was previously the chief executive of the Center for Social Justice, a think tank that she co-founded. And she's an elected official in the House of Lords. So she knows how government works. She understands nonprofit, private, and community-based approaches, which is really a rare and valuable combination of perspectives when we're talking about making policy change. So, Philippa, I'm thrilled to be here to chat with you today. And I want to start because I think most of us don't really know what a baroness is. And we Americans are quite enamored of anything that sounds like British nobility. You know, we're fans of Downton Abbey and Bridgerton, but I don't think anyone who's on here, or very few of us, probably know what a baroness is. So if you could kind of orient us to what a baroness is, how did you get to be one? And I'm curious if that title affects your role or influence in public life and public policy.
Lucy, thank you so much. And thank you for that kind of generous welcome to Leadership Unscripted as well. It's an absolute privilege to be joining you today. And I'm so looking forward to our conversation. To become a baroness means that you have a seat in the House of Lords. And actually, just one correction from your opening introduction, it's not an elected seat, it's an appointed seat. So we have two houses in our parliamentary system, two chambers, one which is our House of Commons, which is elected, and the other is the other legislative house is our House of Lords. And I was appointed into the House of Lords by David Cameron, who was our Prime Minister 2010 to 2016. And he asked me whether or not I would serve in the House. And it was that enabled me to be elevated to the House and to serve as a member of the House of Lords, giving me the title Baroness. You ask whether or not it serves. To be honest, it's a real privilege to be involved in reviewing all legislation that goes through the Commons. So the Commons is very party political, and therefore you have all the normal political fights. The House of Lords is much more a house of experts. And even though it is party aligned, they bring their expertise in a way that scrutinizes legislation and asks the question, will this actually work? So it's a privilege to serve our country in that way as a scrutinizer of legislation.
That's fascinating. And I love that word, scrutinize. What are some of the things that you look for, or sort of flags of, oh, this will work or this won't work, given that you have so much expertise in kind of making things work at different levels?
Yeah, so I think that's a really interesting question. For me, the first principle of any legislation is do no harm. And it is amazing how even with the best will in the world, when there's a great political idea and often it's kind of rushed through the process, that sometimes it has unforeseen consequences. And, you know, when parliamentarians in the House of Commons, they vote according to their party and it gets pushed through and then it comes to us and we look at it and we think, oh, my word, will that actually work, or will it have unforeseen consequences? So do no harm and unforeseen consequences, I think, are my kind of first two things that I'm looking for. Then after that, I think it's actually, does it achieve the objective? So, you know, I've had the privilege of working on the front line with hundreds of people, thousands of people who from very, very disadvantaged backgrounds. So when I'm looking at legislation, in a way, I've got all their faces in my mind. And I kind of think of all the people that I cared for in the hostels that I ran and on the streets. I can ask the question, would it have worked for so-and-so? Would this have worked for that person? And if it wouldn't, then I start asking questions. I kind of think, what are we actually doing here? We're passing more legislation, but is it actually going to help the people that it's setting out to help? So again, those are some of the questions that I have in my mind.
Those are great. And I love that idea of thinking back to kind of an individual in context. I was in the Peace Corps in Guatemala in a small indigenous village, and I often think of specific kids that I used to make tortillas with and, you know, help them herd the sheep and think through, yeah, what would this mean for them?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you say that. We had a young girl who lived with us for 10 years whose background was, she had been homeless and she came to live with us. And sometimes when I took kind of work home, I would just say to her, you know, would this have been helpful for you? And she'd look at it and go, no. and this is where there's often a big gap between, you know, policymakers sitting in offices and the reality of individual lives. And I remember once saying to a policymaker, oh, would you like to meet some of the people that policy might affect? And they just looked back at me and said, no, not particularly. And I thought, really? I was really shocked. It was the first time that I thought, how can you be thinking about introducing a policy and not be thinking of talking to the people that this is going to affect? And I love the fact that you have in your mind too, the people who were making tortillas and you were working with them, because it does, it informs you, I think.
Yeah, so that makes me think of something that when a new government was installed in Guatemala, they committed to ending hunger, which we know is a huge problem. I mean, malnutrition in Guatemala, it's akin to Afghanistan and, you know, some of the worst countries in the world, which is surprising because it's, you know, so close to the US and other pretty well-off countries. There's, you know, good agriculture and whatnot. And so the government wanted people to see the reality of the problem. And so they had these tours where they would take policymakers to stay overnight in the homes of some poor families in the highlands. How does that strike you? I mean, it does help policymakers see sort of the real problem, but it also raises some questions for me of, you know, inappropriate, like voyeuristic tourist kind of, I'm going to see this suffering. So where does that fall for you? And if that's not a great way, what are some other ways of making contact between those populations of those who need support and policymakers who have a lot of power to potentially help?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And it's one of the hardest things, I think, to get the voices of those who are experiencing poverty genuinely represented in the policymaking process. And I've seen the model that you are talking about. I've seen one development further on from that as well, which when I was at the Centre for Social Justice, we used to place members of parliament into grassroots voluntary sector organisations for a week for them to learn about the issue of that particular voluntary sector organisation. And then they would invite somebody from that organisation back to their parliamentary office for a week to see some of the challenges of policymaking in the legislative process. And that's one step further on from what what you are just describing. But in terms of what you were also, I've also seen work is actually people almost forming a panel over a long period of time and genuinely inputting the work at a policy making level from their own lived experience as well. So you get, you have a much better two-way exchange of experience. What have you found, Lucy, to be the most effective?
I really like that two-way. I haven't thought about the framing of it that way. I really like that. I think one of the things you said, I agree, is just, it takes a lot of time. I don't think you can just drop someone in the Highlands and then suddenly, you know, in a poor household and eat tortillas and salt for one night and then really feel like, oh, now I get it. I mean, you were talking about someone you knew who you hosted. It's like longer term exposure and builds the meaning, I think. So, I mean, that's why, you know, when I hire people, I look for even just, this isn't even for policymakers, but I look for people with different kinds of experience. And I think that's really valuable to have worked in different, in small organizations, local organizations, you know, private sector, and just people who have seen from different lenses.
I do genuinely think that the most effective form of life change intervention is a shared life and genuinely living with and alongside. And I know that's really costly, but that's where I have seen the most effective change. And it's very personal. And but when you open up your home and when you share who you are and your life, I think that's one of the most, accepting, honouring things you can do for somebody. But I know that it's very difficult to do that on a large scale. Therefore, we need public policy.
Exactly. So one thing I wanted to talk about a little is, you know, a lot of times in policymaking, what's done is based on what's measured. So this is moving a little bit from the, you know, lived experience and connections to the data. And so I know you were involved in the developing a new poverty measure, and I've worked on different, at the World Bank, looking at different measures, and using different measures can give you different outcomes, which can tell different stories. And the things that we don't measure, it's harder to make the case for. Just recently in one of the classes I teach, we talked about the fact that there's very few measures of welfare or other services and the degree to which they reach LGBTQ communities. And so it's hard to advocate for expanding services when you can't clearly make the case that the uptake isn't there or the service isn't there. Can you tell us a little bit? I'd love to hear a little bit more about the way you thought about revising the measure and why it was necessary, and then maybe we can talk a little bit about what that means.
Yeah, no, absolute pleasure. Might be helpful if I tell a little bit of the story that led up to us wanting to change the measure as well. When I was in government, we were involved. I was a child department for work and pensions, which is all the social security benefits. And there were a lot of changes that we were wanting to introduce. But I can remember the Chancellor of the Exchequer saying to me, the problem with the way we measure poverty, which was the 60% of median income at that time, is that if I crash the economy, technically people are lifted out of poverty because the median changes and therefore the numbers of people in poverty changes. But if I grow the economy, technically by this measure, people are plunged into poverty because the median changes. So he said, I feel like I'm being rewarded for doing the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. And poverty measures have always been really debated in the UK, and there's been a lot of political division over them. And so through a whole series of events, the government abolished the poverty measure as an official statistic, always with the intention of introducing a new one. But it became impossible in government to introduce a new measure of poverty. And in many ways, I think that's true. Those who are making decisions, like marking your own homework, how do you develop the measure and then hold yourself accountable to it? You need an independent measure to be created that holds you to account. So by the time I left government, there was no measure of poverty for the UK, no official measure. There were measures out there that were used, but none that the government was holding itself to account for. And I felt that this was wrong. So I put a commission together of people from the left and the right who would come together constructively to create a new measure. And we took about 2.5 years to do this as a commission. It was called the Social Metrics Commission. And we looked at what a household needs in terms of income and what their unavoidable costs are. So we looked at their income and then their costs. We also looked at the length of time that they were in poverty for, and then we looked at the lived experience, the resilience gap, so their family, their education and skills, their mental health levels, debt, work history. And we created a measure that captured everything from their income, their costs, and their lived experience. And that has been a really unifying piece of work. It really has. People never thought that we'd be able to bring left and right together. And we used to have conversations behind closed doors where the left would say to me, but Philippa, poverty is about money. But we also recognize that it's about family and education and mental health and debt and work. And then I'd have conversations with those on the right who would say, Philippa, poverty is about family and education and mental health and debt and work, but it's also about money. So I kind of thought it can't be beyond the wit of man to actually bring that together and create something that we can all rally around. And that's been a real privilege leading that work and developing the new measure. Although what it shows is something that's really heartbreaking. These numbers won't sound big to in a US context, but 14 million people in the UK is a lot of people. And 14 million people are in poverty and have been really for as long as our measure goes back to measure. So we've seen, you know, we get excited when 200,000 are lifted out of poverty. And we get, you know, very depressed when 200,000, you know, found in poverty. But actually the reality is that we've had this static population that the left have thrown everything at to try and address, and that, you know, through welfare redistribution, the right has thrown everything at through a pro-work agenda to try and address, and really, really it hasn't moved. So I've recently just launched a poverty strategy commission to again bring left and right together to look at, okay, if we're really going to be serious about supporting the people of the UK to thrive and to flourish, what is it going to take? So that's what I'm working on at the moment.
That's so interesting, especially, you know, whenever there's a poverty line, just like you said, it's easiest to focus on those right below, because then you bump them up and you have your good numbers and you show that there's change. But then there's that persistent group of poor who, you know, maybe they get a little closer to the line, and we also know a line doesn't matter, right? I mean, if you're just, you have one foot over the line, your life is basically
the same.
I mean, one of the challenges that I consider when thinking about, you know, that persistent poverty population or, you know, those who are often left behind is just how many things they need at one time. And I feel like there's often a kind of a debate in the water. People say, you know, we need clean water, or we need, you know, financial services comes in another group, and another group says, we need education, we need work opportunities, we need mental health support or health. And really, you need everything. or many of those things. So, I mean, what is your strategy in terms of touching and moving forward that persistence, or kind of chipping away at that?
Well, we are just starting out with our poverty. We spent 3 years doing the Social Metrics Commission. Now we're on the Poverty Strategy Commission. So I will be able to tell you much more in a little while, but I can tell you the way that we're approaching it, if that's helpful. And I'd love your thoughts on it as well from your experience. So we've looked at what are the levers that are available to us. So we're trying to ask the question, you know, what is government responsible for in this? And what is the enabling environment that government is responsible for creating? But then also, what is business's responsibility? So we have in-work poverty in the UK. I'm sure you have in the States as well. Mm-hmm. What are businesses responsible for? What should be the settlement between an employer and an employee so that if they're working full time, can they provide for their family? Then what is civil society's responsibility in this as well? And you know, where does supporting my neighbour right the way through to civil society projects, where does that come in, strengthening communities? And then if I am in poverty myself, what's my responsibility in taking the opportunities that are in front of me? So we're trying to ask the question of every player in this. And at the same time, we are looking at what are the levers that will increase a family's income, but also what are the levers that will decrease a family's costs. Now, some of those can be government provided, but some of that is private sector and market driven forces as well. We're trying to ask the question, if I'm in poverty, the greatest predictor of being in poverty next year is the fact that I'm in poverty now, or the length of time for which I've been in poverty. So how do we make that as short as possible and stop people from coming down into poverty, as it were? And then how do we strengthen their resilience? How do we stabilize families? How do we support educational qualifications, mental health resilience, etc. So these are all the things that we are looking at. But I'd love to hear, Lucy, you're so experienced in this, and also I know that working in a Western economy like the UK, and working somewhere like Guatemala, the issues that you're looking at are quite different. So I'd love to hear some of your perspectives on that as well.
Yeah, I think, I mean, certainly in some of the places I've worked, there's a whole history of, you know, colonization and you know, clearly in our own country, we have a history of slavery. And so there's a lot of baggage, I guess you could say, and just real longstanding discrimination that I think is a foundation that is often not talked about and really difficult to address.
I was going to say, where have you seen the best examples of where communities have felt discriminated against and where the history has played a big role in holding people back? Where do you see signs of hope and where there's a possibility of moving, of change?
That's a great question. And I think also really good to keep in mind, because doing this kind of work can sometimes be challenging in terms of all, you know, layering on all the problems. But I also am very optimistic and love the work and see a lot of places where good things are happening. I'm trying to think of a fun hope story. I mean, I guess it's really when communities are coming together to come up with their own ideas.
Yeah.
And so it's almost despite all these other things that may have put them in a position of being disadvantaged, that there's a sense of, you know, well, we're gonna do this anyway. And so I've seen some places where communities have put schools together for their young children and said, you know, we have parents who can provide activities, and if the government hasn't come together and put a brick and mortar school here, that doesn't matter. And now with all these remote and digital and tech options, they're really, I mean, some of them depend on internet and phones and all that kind of thing, but it also does kind of democratize and spread opportunities for access. And then you have a parent who has on their phone, you know, a couple of games to play with their kid or foods they should feed them. And, or if it's in the UK or the US, you know, parents who are stuck home during COVID and who have access to ways of supporting their kids who are homeschooling. And, you know, I went through it myself with three kids. It's extremely demanding to do that and work. I'm not saying it's at all easy, but I do think there's a lot of hope in terms of the access to resources that can be used in different ways. So that can be used in a institutional context, in a home context, which I think is mirroring a little bit what you were saying about, you know, having government play its role in private sector. It's about putting together these pieces, because then you'll have some overlap and sort of consistency and in support.
I love that human ingenuity, that even when things, you know, you're looking at your community and there's very little there, the way in which people like dig deep and find the resources within them, like you're saying, to start a school or to, there's just so much extraordinary human potential out there that that can change things no matter where people come from. We have written a report called How Nations Succeed, and one of the principles for emerging nations is that they actually decide that they're going to set their own pathway and they are actually going to chart their own direction and create their own national plan and take charge of their future. And even where they're in receipt of aid, they don't let the aid providers dictate to them what they're going to do. They actually say, no, these are our objectives. We'd welcome your aid, but in line with our development plan. And when you see that happen, and Botswana is a really great example of where that's happened, it's just amazing to see. And then that's when the real kind of development comes. And yeah. So I love
Yeah, and that's that. Really countering this colonial control, yeah. Right? It's like, I want your help, but I want it in this way and this way. And I mean, that's as parents, that's kind of what we want our kids to, we want them to need support in specific ways and then not anymore. You said something about, you know, really getting the left and the right to come together and see, even though they had very different perspectives, see this poverty measure as representing both of their sets of values, which yeah. I think can be really challenging. And I know you're a strong advocate of refugee rights, and I'm working on issues of the US-Mexico border, which is a very fraught issue right now. Yeah. Or I mean, it has been for quite some time, but even with our change in administration, it's still, just a very polarizing issue, as I'm sure it is in the UK. I think when we talk about children, sometimes it's a little easier to come together and agree, but I'm struggling with figuring out what kind of narrative can we use to change the dialogue on immigration and refugees and not have the sense of the other who's coming to suck resources and harm the host country and have a sort of more balanced discussion.
Yeah, I think it's one of the conversations we most need to have globally, to be honest. Mm-hmm. There are more people on the move globally now than at any time in history.
And we know it's growing, right? With climate change, it's only people are only going to need to move more.
Yeah. And it's so, you know, and the most vulnerable actually are those who are internally displaced in countries of conflict, who never even make it over a border to a place where they can be classified as a refugee.
And get that international aid, right? Because if you don't, if you're not classified, then you sometimes then fall into the cracks.
So you may have lost everything and still not be viewed as somebody in need of help or assistance. We have a similar highly controversial border crossing between it, which is the English Channel, so between France and the UK, and that is probably as hot a topic as your border situation is as well. I think there has been a deliberate confusing of the narrative around immigration, refugees and asylum and trafficking by politicians to lump them all together into one bucket. And I think that has not helped. So people are confused between somebody who wants to come to the country to contribute economically and somebody who's actually very much in need of our support and care. And I think there's been a deliberate confusing. I also think that some of the journeys that people have to take naturally confuse it. People might have started as an economic migrant, but by the time, you know, they cross Libya or they may well have been trafficked or be a refugee. So I think there's a whole confusing of the narrative. And I think too.
And you say deliberate in a way that if you lump them all together, then you include some of the sort of bad guys. And so you can demonize.
And you make the public go, oh my word, we don't want any of this. Mm-hmm. Rather than actually thinking through, actually, we can have a controlled immigration policy. We can decide who gets to move here to contribute economically. That can be a national debate over that. But actually, surely we are compassionate nations. You know, we are people who, you know, one of our values as British people, one of your values as Americans is actually to be a place where those in need can come and seek refuge. I mean, I have a family member who was evacuated when he was four during World War II and went to Canada and may well be alive today because Canada took him in as a four-year-old. And but that story is replicated thousands of times through the UK, how our own people have sought safety and security and then come back. And that is the story across Western Europe as well, you know, from World War II. And yet we seem to have forgotten that this can happen to us too. None of us are immune from needing a place of safety should conflict break out in our own nation. So I think we need some really grown up conversations globally in the international community. I don't think any one nation can settle this on their own. And I think we need to create a safe environment for those conversations to happen, where nobody feels like a fast one is going to be kind of drawn on them, as it were. But they do need to be had. We've got some very, very serious challenges, and ultimately, this isn't going to go away until we establish safety and security globally, and until we increase prosperity internationally. So that actually you remove the motivation for people needing to travel. If you can be sitting, you know, in an African nation with the same opportunities as you and I have and our children have, then most people don't want to travel. They actually want to stay in their own culture, in their own community, with their own family, as close to home as possible. That's their home. So we have to understand what is it that drives somebody away from what they love and are familiar and is their history and their roots. It's got to be pretty strong to push somebody to do that? I mean, those are just my thoughts. Lucy, I'd love to know. I'm an advocate, but you're the experienced one in this space. I would love to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, I mean, when you're saying, talking about the, we call it in sort of technical terms, the push factors, right? That push people from their home, their culture, their history, that, the push isn't, I just want to leave my home. It's, I'm in danger of, brutal violence or starvation or something like that. And one of the most perverse things is, considering our border, is that, so one of the big threats for Central America, pushing people northward, is gang violence. And it was really the U.S. by sending, there were gangs in L.A. and whatnot, sending people back to El Salvador, where these gangs were then basically exported into Central America, took root, spread even more. Now they're coming back in. There's a whole cycle. And that feels to me like one of the most challenging. Obviously, climate change is huge, hugely challenging, but this really entrenched violence is such a huge push factor. And so, it's so difficult to build in accountability, and it's all these informal networks and corruption with government officials. And so that feels really messy and overwhelming to me. And I think, recognizing, in my class, I have the students in my class on the border try to tell stories about what's really happening with immigration. And our history in this country too, is that we're a country of immigrants, right? Yes. And some of my students went back and interviewed their grandparents about coming over like during the Holocaust or other times. And it really was this sense of reconnecting to, why is it that we're so afraid of immigrants coming in now, or that there's this sense of they're poor and they're affected by violence and then they're scary. It's like people have been leaving places out of fear for a long time. And so I love that idea of connecting to the grandparents' stories, or what you're saying about, your family story.
It was actually
sort of what we can learn from our own stories, better understand that. And I think that, that cuts across political divides. Like we all, maybe your people came from Budapest or, from another place, from Germany. So we are starting to get questions from our audience. So I want to bring voice to some of the people who are listening here with us. So Nicholas is bringing us back to something we touched on, but I'm really glad that he is asking us to go deeper here. What level of impact do you believe the private sector can have, both in the US and abroad, on issues of climate change and adaptation, malnutrition, poverty, so all kinds of social problems? And how can policy level conversations influence private sector behavior? So what works well with public and private partnerships?
So it's a really, really great question. I just see so much innovation taking place in the private sector, and the entrepreneurial spirit is so often found within the private sector. And if you can allow the private sector to really thrive and flourish, then they will address the challenges that of climate change, of the environment, of all those challenges that you have just laid out. Just because, if you look at where all the big revolutions have come from, they've been driven by entrepreneurs finding solutions to problems. And one of the things that concerns me about governments overly subsidizing different solutions at this moment in time is ultimately for solutions to really fly, the public needs to buy into them. They need to recognize that there's a product there that changes their life that's worth it. And I would love to see more of the private sector being innovative in some of our big challenges. And I know that Darden has many who will go into business. And I love the fact that many of your alumni who are listening to this will be the people who solve some of our biggest challenges. Even the scientists who've intervened in order to increase food production, so that the ways in which food is now more resilient to be grown in certain climates, all of this is just amazing the way it can come out of the private sector. It's not saying that the public sector doesn't do this, but some of that innovative entrepreneurial risk-taking spirit, certainly in the UK, is more prevalent in our private sector than our public sector.
Yeah, I would agree. But what happens though when these things aren't taken up? I mean, we have electric cars. They're getting to be more low cost. There, you can go very far. Now there are charging stations all over. And I have a friend who is in Germany and said, you rent a car and it's automatically an electric car and everybody uses them. And here, there's hardly any electric cars, and yet the technology is there, the private sector. So it feels like then there's a gap, and maybe those incentives are what it takes to get over into that adoption or widespread use.
Or actually attracting greater investment so that they can expand to the market. If you were given an electric car, or an electric car was made available to you today, would you use it, or would you still want a different model? And if you wouldn't use it, what development stage does it need to go through before it's like, oh, I wouldn't dream of going back to that old thing? An electric car is exactly what I would like. If you look at how trains developed, they developed, 5 miles an hour to begin with, and, over a short piece of track. And when you're going through such a huge revolution like this, as we are currently, then it will keep innovating until you get to the product that suddenly the market goes, yes, we want it.
Yeah. I see some other questions, one which is a tough one, from Nada, who is asking how we personally self-regulate in the fast-paced environments of policy decisions and humanitarian aid. And you, have been working in, really on difficult human trafficking and heroin addiction and homelessness. I mean, both of us, I guess, things that some people look at us and say, gosh, how do you think about that every day and not burn out? I think that's maybe what Nada's getting at. And the fast pace of needing to make decisions. So I always find that hard to answer. So I'm going to make you go first.
Yeah, but Lucy, we're coming back to you afterwards. Uh-huh. Okay. I'm just buying you time.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that. I'll take what I can get.
It's fine. So I think this is really, really important. If this is about leadership unscripted, the first person that you lead is yourself. And learning to self-manage so that you can carry the full weight of responsibility that enables you to have the impact as a person that is in line with your vision is I think, absolutely essential. And my husband and I, we've given a lot of thought to this over the years, and we've done different things at different times, but I can explain a little bit about what I do now, if that helps. So my day is, I start at 8, and when I'm sitting in Parliament, I go through till 10 o'clock at night. So it's 8 in the morning through till 10 at night, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then it's 8 in the morning through till 6-7 in the evening, Thursday and Friday. So that's my day rhythm. So because that's quite intense, I always start the first hour of my day in personal reflection. It's just a life discipline that I have. I journal. I don't know whether anybody knows about daily pages, but I write 3 pages a day, just in terms of self-management. David and I, my husband and I, we always have breakfast at a restaurant on Friday morning together.
Oh, that's so nice.
We always go out to a restaurant for breakfast. We found over the years that it's the one time of the day where nobody interrupts us. And even when we had children, young children, we always went out for breakfast on a Friday morning. We had brunch as a family on a Saturday. It's a very loved tradition by all of us. And then my husband leads a church, so Sundays is church. Life routines. Everybody needs to find the things that actually renew them and refresh them. There was an old saying which was divert daily, which is why I do an hour a day. Withdraw weekly. We hide ourselves on a Saturday. And abandon annually. My husband is the best person ever at booking holidays. I just wouldn't. I would keep going, but he is very, very good at finding deserts and amazing abandoned landscapes for us to go to. And I love that. So those are some of the things that we do. Lucy, I don't know about you. What are the things that you?
Oh, that's wonderful to hear. I also love having rituals that are sort of things to punctuate and go back to and that are grounding. And again, have a kind of morning practice when it's the only time when nobody's awake in my house. And I really cherish it. I think for me and doing this kind of work, I feel put on myself a pressure to, you know, be doing something that really matters and makes a difference. And when I worked at the World Bank, I felt like, you know, I have this huge reach we're giving, you know, we're working directly with governments and they're millions of dollars. And trying to balance this, like having a big impact and then having that personal impact. And so I actually took some time off from the bank and went to teach in a tiny preschool program because I wanted to make a difference in real individual kids' lives because I felt like the big thing was too big or too distant and I didn't feel it. But I think this pressure I put on myself to maximize, I'm learning to just kind of find something that feels like the right fit for me. So if for a while I'm doing the big picture, that's great. If then I want to focus on, you know, a class of 20 kids and I'm really, you know, helping them learn to read, you know, actually they weren't reading, they were too young, but, you know, recognize letters and express themselves and interact, that I think wherever, there's so many ways to make an impact and it just has to feel right for me in the moment. And then I also like to kind of have things I can go back and forth. So if I only do, you know, some of the family fleeing gang violence and I'm reading about that all the time, it's too much. But if I'm doing that and then I'm teaching a class, that gives me a huge sense of hope, working with students who will go forth into the world. So I don't know, it's totally a huge challenge. It's not easy. So, all right, we have, a couple more questions here. Carolyn is asking, she agrees on the private sector engagement and the ability to innovate, but sometimes the issue is just there's not the ability to make a profit as people who most need the innovation can't afford to pay. That's a great question. I mean, we just recently saw that finally there's a malaria vaccine, right? And so there was so little attention on tropical diseases because these were, you know, people who couldn't pay and who didn't have as much of a voice in the global, you know, dialogue. So how does this get resolved?
That's a really great question. So you introduced me as somebody who leads the Legatum Institute at the beginning of this. But there's actually a whole Legatum family of organizations that was started by the Legatum Group. And one of those is the END Fund, Ending Neglected Diseases. And it's focused on a lot of these tropical diseases. And its history was that a businessman was sitting down reading a newspaper article in the Financial Times. And he read that the drug companies had that were needed to address some of these like illnesses like schistosomiasis, I think it is. Yeah, that's the one. And a whole range of the deworming, all the deworming programs, etc. They had their license had expired, so they were now incredibly cheap. That you could treat an individual like for a dollar, but that nobody had picked up this innovation and they weren't doing anything with it. So the businessman, who is a philanthropist, said, "Okay, well, why don't we do that?" And that led to the start of the END Fund, which is Ending Neglected Diseases. And I do think there's a place for philanthropy in all of this. We talk about civil society. And where there are solutions that are not going to appeal to the market and that government's not getting behind, actually, there's no reason why civil society can't say, we'll do that, we'll pick that up and we'll run with that and we'll scale that. And then are millions of people being treated because this man who read the Financial Times article said, okay, that one's mine, I've got it. And again, there will be students here listening to this who will go on to create a lot of personal wealth out of their extraordinary innovations. And I would, the founders of the Legatum Institute, their mission statement is to generate and allocate the resources and capital to see all people prosper. And they take the profit from their business and they plow it back into these sorts of initiatives. And, you know, this is why asking the question, you know, what can business contribute? What can individuals contribute philanthropically? I think we've all got a part to play. Some will be private sector solutions. Some will be government solutions. Some will be civil society and philanthropic solutions. And some will be the individuals themselves. But if we come together, we can do something quite special.
Yeah, I think that... gets at a question that Leonor had about when there's a contradiction between, I mean, she talks about fighting poverty, but I think addressing tropical diseases or whatnot and economic or industrial interests. And one thing that I feel like we've got to be getting close to this, and I know there are examples of innovation being, how can we find something that can serve multiple purposes? So, you know, if we can... So I, you know, some of the innovations in space technology are also used on Earth, and some of, you know, innovations in AI that can be used for business means can be used for good, right? For human development. Things like prosthetics, right, are using all kinds of really interesting technology. And that wasn't the original design, but look at even if it's an afterthought, that's okay. But to me, if we can find ways of using the innovations that maybe are coming out because they are huge money makers or they're moving forward industry, but if there is a sort of a social good side as well that really harnesses those innovations for positive social change. That's the challenge I'd like to put out too.
Yes, and I think lots of businesses are beginning to explore that, aren't they? They have these kind of breakthroughs and these innovations and they suddenly think, oh, well, maybe that could be used over here in a completely different way to serve this community of people. And I think people are beginning to think a lot more laterally and innovatively like that in quite an exciting way. And maybe, you know, that's something that Darden can really encourage as well, because I know your community of scholars is like really exploring all of these ideas. So, really exciting.
Yeah, it takes me back to what you said early on about this two-way communication and almost embedding people even temporarily in different sectors or different, you know, government going to nonprofit and vice versa. And really, yeah, it's hard during COVID, right, to talk with people outside of our little worlds. But I'm hoping that in some ways, these technologies of Zoom allow us to speak readily across the pond, as they say, and have, you know, participants from around the world and share ideas in real time in ways that maybe were harder when we weren't so digital.
I also think that some of these nations will end up leapfrogging some of the Western nations, because actually when there is a breakthrough, they haven't got any infrastructure that they've got to kind of counter and build the new innovation into. And so we have already seen some of that happening in the kind of banking telecommunications systems.
Cryptocurrency and whatnot.
Yeah, where they're actually now, you know, getting ahead of some of the systems that we have. And I think that's really exciting.
Absolutely. Well, we are about to end. Are there any closing thoughts that you have for our listeners, or anything kind of on your plate next that you're excited about?
I mean, I think what would I say if I were where your students and your community is sitting now? I think just one of the things that I would encourage people to do is to really genuinely pursue the things that they're passionate about. Mm-hmm. And so often our life course decisions are based around what we think we should do, not really the things we really love and want to do. And you only get to live once. And I would just really encourage people to pursue the things that they are passionate about and that bring them alive, rather than living the life that somebody else wants you to live. So that would be kind of one of my passing thoughts. I have numerous projects that I'm working on coming up, but I think that would just complicate things now too.
I echo that so much. That's always something I tell students, and it really is. There's so many ways to make a difference, to make a better world. I mean, whether it's you're baking, you're doing art, you're you know, running for president or becoming a prime minister, you know, starting a business, donating money, all these things. So I agree, and would really encourage all of us to follow our passion. And thank you so much for this fun conversation.
That's
and
great.
your own passion for all these areas, and for joining us today. And to everyone who submitted questions, who was listening, and obviously I'm sure you all have your own ways of contributing. We appreciate you being here, and thanks to everyone who's organized Leadership Unscripted. It's a wonderful medium to have interesting conversation and spark new ideas. And there are numerous sessions throughout the year, so keep an eye out for an upcoming one in the spring. So thanks, everyone. Be well, and have a great afternoon or evening.
Thank you, Lucy.
Leadership Unscripted is a Darden speaker series hosted at UVA Darden DC Metro in Arlington, Virginia. To learn more, visit us at darden.virginia.edu.